Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Welcome to another episode of The Anarchy Gumbos. This is Michael W. Dean, interviewing Kyle Bennett. How you doing, Kyle?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. Everyone will have to excuse the echo. Kyle is currently on the International Space Station. How's the world look from up there?
Like a small blue marble.
So... Kyle's a good friend of mine. We've met in person. We've been shooting. He's been to my house. He's a really smart activist kind of guy, writer, YouTuber. And talk a little about what you do.
I don't really do a lot. I'm not really much of an activist. I don't get out there and do protesting and stuff. I write once in a while, and I've been trying to get my own house in order so I can start doing things more outside instead of just, doing my own thing.
Aren't you moving to
Wyoming?
I'm not
really much of an activist.
Well, I guess I lied then. I think of people who sit in front of a computer all day as activists, but that's just me.
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, division of labor, maybe I do some of the thinking, but other than that. But Wyoming, like everybody else, I'm upside down on my mortgage, so I can't move till I get out from under that.
Hmm. So, you work in the building that was the office of Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no. Go ahead.
What was the zoo like, and what was the outfall like after that happened, like out your window?
Well, I don't actually have a view to it out my window, but I'm on the third floor, she was on the first floor, and I would go out on the balcony and smoke and look down on them. And, after it happened, it was just the place was flooded with cops. There was a bunch of people that came by to put little flowers at her door and hang signs and all that. And, you know, it was kind of just a quiet madhouse for about a week. There was a huge shrine outside the building, hundreds and hundreds of vases with flowers and big well-wishing cards and all that.
Huh. To talk about liberty, man.
About liberty?
Yeah, drop some mad science here.
The science of liberty?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure there's a science to it. I guess the where I'm at now is agorism, which is basically counter-economics, taking the... an approach of using economic leverage rather than protesting and voting and, you know, getting out there and trying to influence the political system. I'm not sure that's quite to the level of a science yet. Some people would call it a fantasy.
Well, I think it requires some integrity. I mean, that chick Stacy Litz was an agorist, and then she narked out all her friends when she got caught doing something illegal.
Yeah, and a lot of people think that, there's a lot of people that call themselves agorists, and there's, just like anything else, there's disagreement on what that actually means.
I don't know that she actually called herself an agorist. I think she called herself the left libertarian, but, you know, agorism often involves doing monetary things outside the law, or can, or
yeah.
not caring about the law.
Yeah, and I was influenced by an article by Hoppe. That was Marxist class theory, or Austrian class theory, where he took Marxist class theory and redesigned the classes as producer classes and parasite classes, which kind of ties into Ayn Rand a bit. So what I've always said is the difference between black markets and agorism is that class consciousness, that you're doing it sort of in a strategic way rather than just doing it for the sake of doing it. Nothing wrong with making a profit, but just trying to make a profit on the black market by itself isn't going to progress the movement at all.
So what's the difference between an agorist and, you know, some gang member on the street that's slanging crack?
Well, what I, like I said, the difference is that the consciousness that you're doing it for some larger strategic purpose.
I guess I'm asking you to expand on what that means. I mean, you know, the gang member slanging on the street isn't necessarily a violent person. You know, some of them are, but isn't necessarily. And his higher purpose is, you know, helping his family pay their mortgage, maybe. Who knows what his purpose is, but... Are you saying that if that kid suddenly had a revelation of, I'm doing this because I don't want to pay taxes and I want to live outside the system, then he would become an agorist without knowing it?
I guess you could say that it's intent in a way, but it's it also has to do with the choices you make. If you're thinking of it as a strategic movement to try to advance liberty, you might make different choices. You might still do the drugs, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing with selling drugs or whatever you want to do because you need to pay your mortgage and support your family. Like you said, the gang members are, you know, they're not necessarily averse to violence, which an agorist would be, except in defense. But an agorist might, because of that awareness of the strategic purpose, might decide to do something other than just sell drugs. And it's a pretty new thing. There's not a lot of, you know, theory that's been, there's not a huge body of theory that's been written about it. So it's,
well, one guy came up with it, right? One guy came up with it.
Yeah.
Some guy who?
Samuel Edward Konkin III.
He was a Dungeons and Dragons fan, wasn't he?
I don't know.
He was.
I don't know that about him.
He was.
But, okay, I'll take your word for it.
which I'm not saying as a criticism. I'm just kind of thinking, like, you know, does that mean agorism is like something made up as fantasy board game role playing thing put into life?
I had not thought of that before. I suppose there's a little bit of that to it. You know, people get inspired by a lot of things. I see connections to things, and, you know, I can see some sort of ecosystem within a game and somebody hitting on, hey, there might be something about this that works outside, but I don't know what his thought process was on that.
What's the difference between an agorist and compare it to a libertarian, an anarcho-capitalist, and a voluntarist?
Well, there you're going to get into a lot of the controversy on what different people think mutualism is. And I have some disagreements with a lot of people, or think agorism is. I mean, I have a difference of opinion with some people who call themselves agorists. I don't say they're necessarily wrong. You know, you're not doing it right. But there's some disagreement. A voluntarist is more of a philosophical position of, this is the way things should be. Every interaction should be voluntary. And that kind of leaves open sort of the leftist approach, which is more of a help each other, work together, you know, and you can extend that all the way to anarcho-communism, which is all-out collectivism. Or it could be a more right propertarian kind of approach. So the voluntarism sort of leaves that open. And that's one of the things about agorism, is it's a philosophy and a sort of a praxis, a sort of ideas about how to do it, how to get there.
What are the ideas of how to get there?
They are admittedly vague at this point, but it's basically, if you can bring, at least my view of it is, if you can work outside the system economically, start with what you can do now, but gradually build up the infrastructure, the networks of friends, different things that allow you to bring more of your economic activity from the state sphere into the agorist sphere, and allow other people to then start moving some of their economic activity to it, that eventually you're building up a something that's free of the state, even if the state is still there. And the theory is that eventually it will weaken the state enough so that they cannot attack this anymore. Obviously, that's a long way off, and that's sort of very speculative. But like I said, there's not a lot of deep theory on this. So it's, you know, a little bit of a, I wouldn't say a leap of faith, but kind of like that, in that, you know, we're abandoning the idea of voting, the idea of protesting. Not entirely, not that those are absolutely off limits, but that's, we don't see those as the path to the solution.
How many agorists do you think there are in the world that use that phrase, that use that term on themselves?
I don't know. My view is kind of limited. I'm mostly involved on Facebook, and a few, you know, a couple other little things. But so I don't know that I have a full view of the world. But I've got a couple, few hundred friends on Facebook who call themselves agorists, and you know, it's a small slice of the world. So, and I'm seeing it from all over the world. I've got friends in Russia that say they're agorists.
What do you see as the future? I mean, you're, how old are you?
47.
Okay. I'm 47 for a couple more days, and I'll be 48.
Okay.
So we're about the same age. What do you think life in America is going to look like when you and I are old men?
We aren't already.
When we're close to dying of old age.
Oh, of old age. Okay.
You know, say in 40 years, what do you think America's going to look like?
You know, it is really hard to predict timing. I'm extremely optimistic about the long term and pretty pessimistic about the short term.
Huh.
I think we're going to go through some sort of, you know, zombie apocalypse, some sort of dystopian period in whatever form. It's almost certain that we're going to go through that at some point. That could happen in 5 years. It could happen. It might not happen for 50 years. You know, but looking a couple hundred years out, I'm really, really optimistic, which doesn't do me any good.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're, when you say short term, you're including like to the end of our natural lifetime. You think it's going to get worse?
It's, I'm almost entirely convinced it's going to get worse, a lot worse, before it gets better. It's going to get dystopian, kind of bad, you know, the kind of things we see in movies now, kind of bad, before it gets better. I don't know how long that'll take.
Do you blame the government for that, or governments of the world for that?
Well, yes and no. Governments are a symptom. They're a symptom of all kinds of things that boil down to people just having bad ideas, bad philosophy, laziness, whatever it is. I'm not one of these that thinks that government is sort of this thing that's always worked entirely against the will of the people, and it's doing its own thing, and it's all powerful, and it can, you know, make all these things happen. If, you know, more than half the population of the U.S. suddenly started thinking agorism was right, the government would probably stop being a problem in a fairly short time.
Really? Because I think if a majority of the people started to embrace, let's not say agorism, let's expand that to all the kind of flavors of related, you know, agorism, anarcho-capitalism, voluntarism.
Libertarianism.
Libertarianism. Yeah, I mean, I think that if, you know, 75% of Americans started espousing those ideas, I think that the government would go under just full attack of try to lock down everybody. And since most of those people don't vote, and, you know, aren't willing to use their weapons that they have and say, there's a line in the sand. And even if 1% of them did, you know, it wouldn't be a revolution at this point. It would be a bunch of Ruby Ridges that would involve drones, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not all that hopeful for that, you know, education leading the way. Although that's what I spend 24 hours a day now doing, is trying to educate people.
Well, I'm not hopeful about education solving the problem either, because I don't think that even the 50% is achievable. I'm just saying that if it were, if 50% of people started truly believing this, yeah, I think the government would try to go all out on attack, but it would then the government would be fighting the uphill battle. But that 50% is not achievable. You cannot get people in this culture in the main to start believing this stuff.
Do you think 10% is achievable?
Maybe, and I don't think 10% would do a whole lot of good.
So what's the point?
What's the point of what?
What we're doing.
Well, it depends on what we're doing. If we're voting and protesting, there may be some tactical benefit to it, but on the long term, there really isn't a point.
Wouldn't voting be kind of violating what it is to be an agorist, or am I wrong on that?
There's so much argument about that, and it gets really heated, and I'm going to hear about it. Whatever I say now,
I mean, to me, about it tomorrow.
But
to me, it sounds like anarcho-capitalism is agorism, where you've made a pledge not to vote.
Well, yeah, that's one description, I guess. I'm on the side of not voting. I think it's a bad idea.
Why do you think it's a bad idea? The thing you have to remember is the listeners of this podcast are mostly people who know about the stuff we're talking about, but about a quarter of them are new to it because it's people that came in as fans from my old how-to books and my old movies, which were not libertarian at all. So I usually ask people to, like, explain what they mean when they say the gun in the room or whatever. So go ahead and explain that.
Well, and I'm not going to say that you're an evil person if you vote. There's a lot of, my fellow agorists and anarcho-capitalists that argue that voting is a violation of the non-aggression principle because you're trying to leverage the force of the state. And, you know, I suppose technically that's true, but part of the argument is your vote doesn't count. So if it doesn't count, you're not really doing that anyways. But for me, I decided after 2006 that I just wasn't going to vote anymore. At that point I was starting to see the futility of it. And once I decided to vote, it was kind of like blinders coming off that I didn't even know I had. I started seeing everything so much more clearly because previous to that, everything I saw, as objective as I tried to be, got filtered through how does this affect my side. And so I started seeing everything. It surprised me even how much more clearly and objectively I could see things. And so my argument for not voting is that it limits you in terms of that filter means that you don't think outside the box as much as you could be. And you're not seeing things clearly enough. And since your vote doesn't really count, you're losing all of that for this trivial sort of ritualistic say that doesn't really mean anything.
I think the Ron Paul movement or the Ron Paul candidacy has proven that your vote doesn't count. There have been so much shenanigans. I mean, right here in Wyoming, you know, I did an interview on this podcast with a guy who is a, you know, lifetime Republican, who's a Ron Paul supporter, who is a national GOP delegate who was at the, you know, convention and swore up and down. And there's video of this, actually. It's, you know, it's fact that the GOP people basically locked out any Ron Paul votes and like voted double for Romney and, you know, like made a point of it, like heads of the Wyoming GOP, like I'm voting twice. And the reason they did it was in case Romney won, they could challenge it for a recount or for a revote on the fact that one of them intentionally voted twice and made a point of it.
You mean in case Ron Paul won?
Yeah, sorry. In case Romney lost, yeah.
So they could basically, they were creating a grounds for appeal. Even
yes.
though they were the ones they were appealing against themselves.
Exactly. That's said better than I've heard anyone say it. Yep.
Yeah. I've seen things like that, and you know, my take has always been that the system of government, state, whatever you want to call it, it's kind of like an organism of its own, with its own interests, its own imperative to grow. and it also has an immune system against things like Ron Paul. And, you know, that immune system can take the form of, you know, just propaganda or, you know, the way people start to spin issues, the kind of things you're talking about, the shenanigans.
Violation of GOP bylaws.
Yeah, and but it can be really, really subtle. You can get all kinds of interconnected networks of pressure going on that even if he were to win and take office, he couldn't do, you know, 1% of the things everybody's claiming he's going to do the first day. Mm-hmm. You know, he would probably get no legislation passed. There's a few things he could do with executive orders.
Yeah.
Very likely those would not actually get executed.
And if they did, they'd be undone by the next president, whether he's a Democrat or Republican.
Right. He might be able to get a few people out. You know, let's say he, the first day he signs 10,000 pardons for drug dealers, right? They can drag their feet and take 2 or 3 years to release those people.
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of things that they can do to.
And if he did an executive order to, like, say, you know, dissolve the IRS or the DEA, mm-hmm. those people would just show up for work anyway, and the checks would keep coming, you know, somehow,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, they'd probably get paid, and it might put a little bit of a glitch in the enforcement. But there's a whole lot of ways they can extract money from people. So if he stopped the IRS, you'd find suddenly bills for, you know, your water bill go up by the amount that you would have paid income taxes or something like that.
Yeah, it would go from $30 a month to like $3,000 a month or something.
Yeah,
or $1,000 a month.
You know, in income based water bills or something like that. I mean, yep. You know, and the president is not as powerful as everybody says. He's the most powerful man in the world, yeah, if the establishment is willing
agrees.
To let him be.
Yeah.
And if they're not, there's only so much he can do.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So, Ron Paul, we were talking about Ron Paul, which, you know, I call myself the head of non-voting anarchists for Ron Paul. I don't think he's going to change anything politically, but I think he is a great philosopher, even though he doesn't totally abide by the non-aggression principle because he is in office, which kind of sounds like me having half measures about somebody, but it's really not, because I believe he is at this point a full-on anarchist and is going to reveal himself as such when he's out of politics in a few months. Go ahead.
I think he said recently that he wants to he wants a reduction of the income tax to zero or something like that. I think you might be right. I don't know how fully consistent he is, but I have a lot of respect for the guy. I mean,
he's consistent to himself.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he's consistent if you want to analyze him from, well, he talks about non-aggression and he's a politician. But, you know, I think he got into politics because he was upset with the politics, you know, when he was in Texas decades ago and said, mm-hmm. I'm going to do something about it, and ran and somehow won and somehow kept winning, which is kind of surprising in Texas. But, you know.
Yeah, he's not pure, you know, and if we're going to apply a purity test to him, he'd fail. But the point is that if he's 95% there, I'm happy about it. I'd love to see him win. I just don't think it's worth the effort that it would take to put him in there.
He's not going to win.
No.
I made a point of several 6 months ago of when I decided that. Of that I wasn't going to say it on the internet, but I'll say it on the internet. He's not going to win. What do you think is going to happen to all the Paulites the day after Romney or Obama become president again?
That's a big question. I see a lot of people now This could be selection bias on my point, where since I'm focused on it, I'm seeing it. But it looks like the sort of greater anarchy sphere has exploded in the last 4 years.
I think Ron Paul has something to do with that, because I think he brings people to Minarchist and educates them, and then it's not that much of a leap to anarchism.
Well, and that was my point. I think he had a lot to do with it. He brought a lot of people into the sort of general libertarian mindset. And the effect of that carried over, and the organization from 2008 carried over. The organization he has now is really something to see. The things he's doing at the state conventions, his organization, which I think he's probably as surprised about it as we are. I get the feeling that he's not actually organizing this, that it's sort of happening truly grassroots.
Which is kind of funny, because I've heard Romney campaign people, or maybe even Romney, talk about, like, how can we bring in the Ron Paul vote? And I'm like, you can't. You know, 98% of those people, when Romney is run as the GOP guy, are just not going to vote, or they're going to go vote for Ron Paul and write him in, you know?
Yeah. Well, he'll get more than 2% of the people that are right now behind Ron Paul. In terms of the hardcore organizers, I think he's going to get a very small number of them. But, you know, guys like Romney don't understand philosophical consistency. It's not just that he isn't consistent. He doesn't even understand what that means.
Most politicians don't, but Romney really doesn't. I mean, Romney is famous for flip-flopping on major issues, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one thing about Ron Paul is he has been consistent for like 30 years in public, you know.
Right.
I think the only thing that's changed about him is he screams a little less than he did in the 70s. There's some videos of him on – there's a great video of him on like the Morton Downey Jr. show.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the name. I saw that. That was great.
Where he's arguing for drug legalization with some hardcore statist, you know, gun warriors. Yeah. And they're all screaming at each other. And Ron Paul's screaming. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, he sounds like me on the internet 20 years ago or 15 years ago.
you kind of sound like the bad Quaker.
How do you mean?
Your voice. Right now I'm listening to you. You know, last night I was doing a mumble conversation with Ben Stone, the bad Quaker, not recording it, just chatting.
Okay.
And I'm like kind of deja vuing, because your voice sounds like his a bit.
Wow. I've only ever heard him talk on your podcast a few weeks ago, so.
He's awesome.
I haven't ever really followed him. I didn't know much about him. I'd heard the name kind of floating around, but I never followed him. So, you know, I got a little bit more interested when I saw when I heard your podcast. I went to his website and his blog, and I still haven't listened to his podcast. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, so I need to get more.
I listen to them constantly. I leave LRN.FM on in the background the same way that liberals leave NPR on in the background.
Yeah, I did that one day, and I just haven't gone back to it. It's just I haven't been in the mindset sort of to listen. I do a lot of reading about stuff, and when I listen to things, it's more, you know, I watch Hulu or listen to music or something. But yeah, I kind of need to get more into having podcasts going in the background.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, where were we?
Oh, we're off on
a sense we had gone off on a tangent, and I forgot what it was a tangent.
It was a Ron Paul tangent.
Oh, okay. But so, anyways, I like the guy. I have a lot of respect for the guy. I'd love to see him win. And that was the question you had asked: what's going to happen to
the Paulites?
His people, the Paulites. And I'll admit, I've occasionally used the term Paultards, but you know that's sort of in my.
I like Paulites because it's a little bit of a poke without completely dismissing them. It's a poke of, like, you know, they are religious.
Yeah, and, you know, there are some people that out there that deserve the term that go on and on about how he's going to win for sure, and B, he's going to stop everything as soon as he gets in, you know, and that's just fantasy.
Bad Quaker has a really interesting take on it. Bad Quaker is a non-voting anarchist who's He's about 10 years older than us, and he's been a Ron Paul supporter for 30 years. I mean, since Ron Paul was in the Libertarian Party running for things. And he says he hopes Ron Paul does not win because they would kill him if he did. He's convinced that if Ron Paul became president, that within months or days, he'd be assassinated by somebody in the government, probably.
I think that's probably not true, because I think they realize that he'd be more valuable
as a martyr.
Dead, not dead. Well, he'd be more valuable to us as, you know, sort of the Obi-Wan Kenobi to become stronger than you know. But if he wins, it's in some ways a golden opportunity for them
to let it fail,
to discredit the entire ideas.
Yeah.
The body of ideas.
Well, there's also a theory of some other prominent libertarian, I can't remember who it is, it might be Walter Block, of somebody saying that they might let him win because they imagine that things are going to collapse in the next 4 years and they want someone to pin it on.
Well, you know, I've noticed that the sort of mainstream media and the prominent leftist pundits have sort of almost in unison, like a military about face, turned on Obama.
Who has? I'm sorry.
Like the mainstream media and the leftists, the statist leftist pundits, the famous ones. You know, I think what was it? Matt Damon even turned on him. Chomsky's turned on him
for not being socialist enough.
Just in general, just found ways to criticize them for things that they never would have criticized them for before.
Is any of it about war? Because I'm wondering where the war protesters are.
Yes, I think Chomsky has about the war. I'm not sure on that. I think he has.
Well, Chomsky's a little smarter than your average, you know, Hollywood liberal. He's not Matt Damon, you know.
No.
He can write. Chomsky can write an essay. I don't think Matt Damon can read.
It crossed my mind. I've heard speculation that maybe they realize that he's an anchor and they're going to try and give it to Hillary. It crossed my mind that the Democrats might have decided to throw it to Romney for the reason you said, that they think it's going to collapse in 4 years or get so bad that it's, you know, going to destroy who's ever in office, and that they would rather have the Republicans be in office.
I also think they might want to hand it to Romney because he'll do a bunch of stuff they want done that they don't want to be blamed for, like far more military intervention, far more, you know, rounding up citizens, outlawing free speech, outlawing guns possibly. I mean, Romney supported the assault weapons ban as governor.
Sure, yeah.
Which is really bizarre to me because the NRA is backing him now. I can't believe that. I mean, I canceled my NRA membership 2 years ago when they backed Harry Reid. But
I actually signed up just to get into a gun show for a discount and then stopped paying any attention to him. You know, it's the only Nixon can go to China thing. If the Democrats try to pass a gun ban, you know, there could be shooting in the streets. If the Republicans do it, it's going to go quietly.
Why couldn't the Democrats have gone to China? Why did Nixon have to do that?
Because Nixon was the most vocal anti-China person, you know, or he represented that faction.
So if a Democrat president had gone to open up trade with China, they would have called him, it would have been like Hanoi Jane kind of thing?
Yeah, right. And so when Nixon did it, it was like, oh, there's a good reason, there must be a good reason for it, you know.
I remember Nixon, man. Nixon taught me to distrust the government. I mean, he was president when I was a kid, and it was like, I remember being 5 years old and being appalled at the Vietnam War, watching on TV, and like basically becoming a conscientious objector at five. It was the first strong political opinion I held, and it's the one I've had most consistently my whole life. And then I remember when he was impeached when I was like 10, maybe 8, 10, you know, seeing him on TV and like turning to my mother and going, did the president lie? I thought the president was the best man in the world. And like, you know, she was a Republican and she kind of was shamed, like trying to explain it to me. And it just made me instantly realize that presidents and politicians weren't the saints that I was taught in school and at home to believe.
Yeah, I don't actually have any clear memories of Nixon in real time. I was very politically unaware. My parents were, you know, the classic apathetic, you know, we'll go in and vote every time, but other than that, don't pay any attention to it. I didn't really start getting politically aware until about the time Reagan came in. A little bit with Carter. And then when Reagan came in, I started, and at that point it was a lot of half-assed ideas that didn't make any sense, or at least don't make sense to me now.
I got really amped up about Reagan and had a lot of half-assed ideas. I mean, now, knowing what I know now, I hate the guy, and I think he's a tyrant, and he was horrible, and a murderer, and was not a small government guy like he claimed. But I hated him because I was into the punk rock movement by 1982, and... You know, half the bands had Reagan in their name. I mean, it was like Reagan Youth, you know, the Naked Ray Gun. You know, I saw Dead Kennedys and MDC, the band Millions of Dead Cops, MDC, July 4th, 1984, on the Washington Mall with about 8,000 people there at an event called Rock Against Reagan.
Yeah, I wasn't anywhere near that aware then. I remember sort of hating Reagan while he was in office, but again, it was, you know, a half-assed, I heard something bad in the news, so I don't like him kind of thing. Really liking him shortly after he was out of office, to the point where I was like a huge Newt Gingrich fan. Ugh. During the contract with America days. And then, you know, that sort of started evolving into libertarianism, and you know, it eventually evolved into where I'm at now.
I mean, I'm saying ugh to you having been a Newt fan, but around that time, I voted for, not long after that, I voted for Nancy Reagan when I lived in California. I mean, not Nancy, Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, okay.
I voted for her, and well, I voted for Dianne Feinstein as mayor of San Francisco.
Well, and you know, everybody goes through that evolution, and
my wife in the other room. Did you just go, bah, DJ? Yes. I forgot. I didn't even know she was awake. She's reading a book. I thought she fell asleep, but I just heard this, bah.
But she probably did it in that really clear radio voice, right?
Yeah, DJ, you voted for Reagan, DJ. Yeah. She's like, yes, and now she hates Reagan. But Reagan talked a good talk. He had some fabulous quotes that, when taken out of context, out of the context of that they came out of Reagan, are great. I mean, one of my favorite ones is that thing, the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I mean, that's a running joke in our movie Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. I think there's about 8 times that one of the oppressive characters says, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
Well, it's a running joke in all of politics now. You know, he not only had some great quotes, he had some great speeches. If you hear some of his speeches...
Well, the tear down this wall speech is great, too.
Oh, yeah. But he made a speech for Goldwater about socialism that was really good when Goldwater was running. You know, I think that he probably was sincere, at least at some point in his life. But... like we're talking about with Ron Paul, in order to be president and to be effective, you have to sort of decide, okay, I'm going to be pragmatic about it. And no matter what your convictions are, you have to throw them away to get anything done. And he got some good things done. He got some bad things done. I mean, the war on drugs is probably his most
legacy.
Yeah. He didn't start it, but he sure turned it into a war.
Nixon started it, and I mean, really, it started in the 30s, but the real, I mean, with the term and the militarization of it, it started with Nixon. Nixon also started the EPA.
Yep.
He passed the ERA, and he took us off the gold standard, didn't he?
Yep, he did.
Not saying, you know, and when I'm criticizing the ERA, I'm not criticizing women's rights. I'm criticizing the clusterfuck that the ERA has produced of, like, kind of some are more equal than others legislation that, you know, hurts everything. Whereas I think that that would have evolved in society naturally. And I believe in voluntary association, because so I think anybody should be able to not hire anybody. And I think that by this point, the people that wouldn't hire a woman or wouldn't pay them well would be out of business.
Yeah, and that's true of people who wouldn't hire blacks, and it's becoming true of people who wouldn't hire gays. You know, the ERA was sort of an Orwellian named thing, like they all are. Whenever you hear something named equal rights, you know that it's not equal rights. It's more rights for us.
They're getting really Orwellian in the naming of bills, like more so than ever. You know, the Patriot Act comes to mind, and that thing, that new law that like outlaws protesting anywhere that the Secret Service is called like the National Buildings, Federal Buildings Improvement Act or something like that.
Oh, I didn't know what it was called. I would have guessed something.
It's got the
like
word Improvement Act in it. You would have guessed what?
Of course. I would have guessed something like the Free Speech Enhancement Act or something.
Well, and then there's free speech zones. That's a pretty Orwellian thing. You know, it's a pen they put you in well away from the person you want to protest so they can't see you.
Well, and it's a confession that every other zone is not a free speech zone.
Yeah, there you go.
So, you know, it's, yeah, they're very Orwellian, and it gets to the point where when you hear, you know, Reinvestment and Recovery Act, okay.
That's TARP, right?
We know that the two things it's not about are reinvestment or recovery. Whatever else it's about, we know it's not about those two things.
Yeah, I mean, if you put it into terms of, you know, like people in recovery from drugs, the TARP Recovery Act would be like helping a heroin addict recover by stealing a bunch of money and buying him a bunch of heroin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, reinvestment is like, we're going to deplete everybody's savings. Then we're going to call it investment.
You know, I understand from every news item I see and every person I talk to that the economy is getting worse. But my personal economy has gotten better in the past 2 or 3 years. Is that true with you?
Yeah, definitely of mine.
Why? What's going on, man?
Well, I'm in the kind of business that thrives in this environment. So
what is it? Banking software?
Yes.
Is it? I knew you did software programming, but I just guessed.
I don't write it in the sense that it's, you know, I write the whole thing. I work for a company that makes risk management software.
Do you like the movie Office Space?
Yes.
There aren't a lot of movies about where the heroes are guys who write bank software. That's why I asked.
Yeah. Well, and I've worked in enough cubicle farms to relate to it in generally. I can relate to the general environment. And I haven't had the kind of hell environments that they've had. But I understand. I've seen enough bits of it to understand and relate to what that movie's about.
Cool. Well, we got about 5 more minutes. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. What do you want to talk about? I didn't come very mentally prepared with a topic.
I didn't either. You called me 45 minutes before we were supposed to start. I'd been awake. You did not wake me up, but I'd been awake for about 90 seconds. And you were like, am I early or late? And I'm like, are you here early? Let me call you back. I'll call you back.
I couldn't remember which time zone we'd agreed on.
Yeah, because you're in Arizona that has not only – it's a weird time zone because it's different times of the year because you guys don't honor daylight savings time. Or part of the state does and part of the state doesn't. Is that it?
No, I think it's the whole state. There's a few states where it's mixed, like Indiana. The part that's Chicago suburbs don't change.
You know, the interesting thing about time zones is everybody thinks they go by hours, but some in the Middle East go by like an hour and 15 minutes off from everybody else.
Yeah, and there's a few half-hour time zones around the world.
Why is that? Because they just want to be contrarians to the Western world? Or,
you know, it's so political, and if you look at the actual borders of the time zone, the boundaries, it's very gerrymandered, just like congressional districts.
Yeah.
I mean, part of that is you don't want to have a city split down the middle.
Yeah.
But there was some big political row with something like, I want to say Tuvalu or something, where they're right on the international dateline. And they decided to switch to the other side of the dateline because they had initially been doing business with the U.S., so they wanted to be sort of on the same day as the U.S. And they figured out that now they're doing more business with Asia, so they wanted to be on the Asia side of it. I mean,
think about that. Like, governments not only control your money, they control the time.
Yeah,
You know, there's one somewhere in America that like gerrymanders along a state line, or it goes along a state line and then gerrymanders into one town of another state and then back to the state, and it's because there's a factory on that side in that state where people who live in the other state work, so they want to be on the same time zone.
Same time zone, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, you know, they commute 3 miles, but it's to a different state in a different time zone, so they put that factory town in that time zone.
And that's the problem you always have when you start drawing arbitrary lines, is you get these absolute changes where somebody is just barely on one side or the other, and from that point of view, it's a really silly boundary.
I believe that with laws, too. I mean, an interesting thing for me is when you drive from Utah into the bottom left corner of Wyoming, you cross the border, and literally right there, there's like 4 firework shops, 4 liquor stores, and a porno shop.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and I grew up in Chicago in the northwest suburbs, and Illinois was 21-year-old drinking age, and Wisconsin was 18. Yeah.
Yep. And I grew up in New York next to Pennsylvania, and we were 18 and they were 21. And guess what every 19-year-old did every weekend, every Friday night?
Well, it was a convoy. There would be – because the roads up to Wisconsin were mostly these little two-lane highways, not freeways, just, you know, two-lane highways that went through town squares and stuff. And you'd see it, you know, 9 o'clock at night going north – there'd be a line of cars miles and miles long snaking through the town square of some town of 5,000 people. And then at 3 o'clock, the same line would come snaking back, except now they're all drunk.
Cool. Well, I think we're at the end of our time here. Kind of already? Interesting. Well, do you want to do more?
It's up to you.
I can. Yeah, let's stop the file. I just want to say, when you said 9 o'clock at night, I was looking at my clock, and as you said 9 o'clock, it went from 8:59 to 9 o'clock. That was weird.
Yeah, well, I timed that.
Oh, did you? No, you didn't, because it's 8 o'clock where you are. All right.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
Dote coming, huh?
Yeah, we were just joking about it. I was talking about maybe editing out the first 10 minutes of this because you were kind of sleepy. And what did you say? You weren't...
Said that I hadn't really come mentally prepared with talking points and a topic. And you kind of threw this open-ended question, you know, tell me about this. And I wasn't really prepared for it, so I wasn't really... I didn't have anything... pre-planned to say about it.
And then you got warmed up to the point where when I said, okay, we're at the end of our time, you're like, no, we aren't. I'm ready to go. La, 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 la. And I mentioned when we were on the break, I said something about, like, you know, I mean, nothing critical about you, just I generally interview people who do this all day, every day. And, you know, I say, so tell me about your beliefs. And 20 minutes later, I'm trying to get another question in and I can't. And I was thinking about Stefan Molyneux, and you said, I could what?
Well, you had said that you just sort of did that same open-ended question. You asked him, so tell me about your beliefs. And he went on and on. I was saying, with Stefan, you could probably go out to a restaurant, have dinner, come back, and he wouldn't be finished yet.
And I said, let's start recording and finish this conversation. And the thing that I was going to say that I didn't say yet when we were recording was when I did my conversation with Stefan Molyneux twice, I got up and went and peed and came back, and he was still talking, and, you know, there was no break.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, he does this all the time. He's practiced. He's got – and I don't mean to, you know, make it sound trite, but he's got a skill. He knows what to say for just about anything.
He really does.
Open-ended. You know, I've never done this kind of thing before, so.
I do this every day. But I'm still not as I'm not as bam 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 as Stefan Molyneux. You know, did that guy go to Toastmasters or something? He's such a public speaker, good public speaker kind of guy.
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he did.
I'm doing some work with a guy who went to Toastmasters this weekend. Did you go to Toastmasters?
No, Sally was kind of really heavily involved in it before and shortly after I met her.
Explain what Toastmasters is for people who don't know.
It's a club. People get together. I went to a few of the meetings with Sally. It was probably 10 or 15 people, and they sort of have it's all about learning to do public speaking or speaking in front of an audience.
It's so about learning to master toast.
Yeah. Well, I think the name comes from, you know, when you are giving a toast at a meal wedding. Or something. And
a wedding.
And
you,
Right. But they have sort of a pre-planned set of exercises and kind of like in gaming achievement, you know, achievement accomplished, where if you give a certain kind of speech, you get a little check on your resume or whatever, and, you know, you move up doing that. And it seems actually pretty useful, and it was kind of interesting, the couple meetings I went to. I don't really have that urge to be a public speaker, so I didn't ever participate.
I'm doing a project with a guy who has been to Toastmasters a bunch. He's coming up this weekend. He's a gun training guy, and we're doing a DVD series called Gun Training and the Non-Aggression Principle.
Okay.
Which is two things I don't see combined a lot, you know, in visual media. So it should be fun.
Yeah, and the mainstream opinion of that is that they're contradictory.
Yeah, that's kind of the point, other than that, other than producing a good gun and self-defense training DVD, because this guy's really, really good at it. Mm-hmm. It will be fun.
Yeah.
And it will combine those two ideas in a way that isn't often in
media. Yeah, and it'll make people's brains explode.
That's the point. Yeah. I like to, I mean, anything that can make people's brains explode is great, and making a little money at it is just gravy.
And being legitimately educational in the process.
Yep. Is yep.
Even better bonus.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like to make people's brains explode, but I don't have quite the same level of access to the general public.
As what?
Well, as you do, I mean, you're...
Yeah, you do. I have an internet connection. That's my access to the public. You probably have a better internet connection because you don't live in Wyoming.
That's true. You have a reputation and a bit of a following that I don't have, so...
I didn't have that.
No, I know.
You make that, You make that.
I know.
You should go to Toastmasters and become a distinguished Toastmaster. That's the highest honor in Toastmasters. I'm reading the Wikipedia page. DTM, as they call it, Distinguished Toastmaster.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't really have the urge for public speaking. I did a few YouTube videos, and it was, you know, I realized that I've got the face for radio, and I don't have the voice for radio, so I stick to writing.
You have a good voice. You have a good voice.
Yeah.
There, you know, your voice is pleasant to listen to and calming, which is... radio friendly. A lot of people have horrible voices. I can't listen to a lot of people.
Yeah, like Ron Paul.
He does have a goddamn kids, get off my lawn kind of voice.
The Federal Reserve is is inflating our money.
I know. Well, it probably worked for him too. If he had a calming voice, people would fall asleep.
But it's not one of my things. I like to write. And I do a better job at it than I do speaking, so.
I write for a living, but I don't like to read a lot of writing because I don't have the patience for it. I really don't. I like audio, and I don't like video media that much. I mean, I do for entertainment, but not for education.
Yeah.
I watch a lot of movies, but I don't watch a lot of YouTube libertarian anarchist type videos. I listen to a lot of libertarian anarchist audio media. You know, I said before the cast, I said, I put on LRN.FM and listen to it in the background the same way that liberals listen to NPR.
Or conservatives have Rush on in the background.
Yeah,
conservatives. And then Hannity and then Glenn Beck. I used to do that. Just put on the station that had all those guys and leave it on all day.
Yeah, I think my wife used to do that in the car, but mainly because she liked that show of the guy who talks about money and gold and investing and what's his name?
There's so many of them. Which one?
DJ, what's the name of that guy that talks about gold and investing and debt that you like? Okay. She says Dave Ramsey, and he does not believe in gold investing. But
he does not.
You know,
he is adamantly against gold. It brings up an interesting point because I like Dave Ramsey a lot, and I've called him the most effective agorist activist out there.
Interesting.
Because I don't know if you've ever seen George Donnelly wrote an article about I forget what it was called, something like 10 Steps to Peaceful Evolution or something. But he described sort of an agorism stage zero, and ever since I've used that term for it, stage zero, which is sort of like clean up your own house, you know, reduce your debts, reduce your dependencies on things so that you're nimble and flexible and traveling light effectively. And that, you know, that's kind of the way to start, because once you get to that point where you don't have a lot of debt, you're not tied to the system, and so you can be more effective at doing agorism in other ways.
I think that we, DJ and I, live Ramsey stuff probably without even his help, or maybe with his help. I haven't really thought about it, but we have a mortgage, and that is literally our only debt, and we canceled our credit cards. We only have a debit card. Doesn't he say to do all those things?
Yeah. And and he's apparently, if you can believe his own hype, which I think some of it's probably honest, he's gotten a lot of people to that state. Now, the problem is he doesn't – to that state of being debt-free, not entirely dependent on the system.
His show kind of reminds me of an AA meeting for debt. You know, like, and he's the sponsor or the group secretary or group leader or something. Like, people call in and they're like, you know, I did this. We still have debt, but we're working it down. And he's like, you know, good. Like, here's your 30-day chip or your 1-year chip kind of thing. That's kind of the feeling of like reinforcement he gives.
Yeah. But whatever it is, he's gotten a lot of people to that stage. He just doesn't, you know, really believe in the follow-up part about, okay, now you can go out and be an anarchist. But that, you know, that's fine. The more people that are sort of independent and can tolerate losing their job or not being in debt, the better off.
I'd say, in a way, it's more important. I think it's more important to practice that than to know all the terminology and, you know, be an expert internet anarchist.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, it's better to be that and not be a knowing anarchist or an anarchist at all than to be a knowing anarchist and be heavily in debt and terrified of losing your job and terrified of losing your health care benefits and all that.
And working for the state, I know several people who are, as you described, and work for the state and are terrified of losing their jobs. They have to keep working for the state.
Yeah, and I see a lot of people that work for the state, and they don't like it. They're chafing under it. But, you know, I don't blame somebody for doing what they have to do.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, Ramsey's gotten a lot of people to a good state. And he's got a saying that I love, which is, live like no one else today so you can live like no one else tomorrow. I really like that saying, but I just wish we could somehow take all the people that he's gotten to be free of debt and turn them into anarchists, but...
Maybe we could buy ad time on his show. Maybe Freedom Fiends should buy ad time on the Dave Ramsey show. I'll look into the prices. They're probably astronomical, but...
Probably, yeah. It's a huge show. But yeah, I mean, that would make some heads explode.
I doubt... They probably wouldn't take the ads. He's probably well off enough that he can be picky. Yeah. And, you know, they'd probably have one of their assistant producers look at Freedom Fiends, and they'd scroll down the page and see a post called, you know, I'll be happy if Obama and Romney get cancer, and just go, no, we're not touching this.
Yeah. He's a little bit skeptical of government in general. He's kind of a small government guy, but not an anarchist.
Well, I mean, really, I think that the definition of a conservative, the true definition of it, is a constitutionalist. And I think Ron Paul is a constitutionalist. I think that the Constitution, the United States Constitution, is probably the best constitution that's been written in history. But it was ignored by 8 years after it was written, you know, with the Whiskey Rebellion,
right.
You know, by the people who signed it. And It's not perfect, and it allows for aggression, and it allows for taxation, and it allows for pretty much unlimited war as long as the Congress goes along with it. So I'm definitely not a constitutionalist, but a lot of people, most people that call themselves conservatives are not conservatives. They're not constitutionalists, and they, you know, people that wave the constitutional banner like Romney and Santorum laugh at Ron Paul, who's the only constitutionalist, the only real conservative in the room, you know?
Right. They to them, the Constitution is a symbol, like the flag.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, you know, proclaim your fealty to it, but it doesn't have to actually be true.
Did you know about May 1st, what Obama did?
Oh, I forget. There was something he did on May 1st, and it was, yeah, I don't remember what it was, though.
May 1st is, internationally, in a lot of places, it's a socialist holiday. It's a, right. It's the workers' holiday. Yeah. And some countries, like America, right-wingers in the past have turned that into Love America Day, or what did he call it?
Loyalty Day. I remember now, yeah.
Right. And that was a, you know, right-wing thing from back in the day, and no one's really paid attention to May 1st as Loyalty Day for a long time until this year. Obama gave some really glowing proclamation of how we need to be loyal to America and sacrifice to America. And I'm thinking, what, like kill our bring our children to sacrifice at the gods' feet? Or I guess that's what the army is, you know, military. Yeah.
Well, and it does seem that he is... He seems to want to make the loyalty to him. He's even, you know, let loose a few statements having to do with the military about how they're working for him.
Yeah.
And it's always been, a thing in America that the military is loyal to the country and the Constitution, not to the president. And that was, of course, one of the things that Hitler did in Germany, was to say that, you know, made the military sign a loyalty oath to him personally. And, you know, of course, as soon as you say Obama has even the slightest thing in common with Hitler, then, you know, you get dismissed.
Okay, I'll say this. I'll say this. If we want to avoid that, I'll say this. I think he wants to be king of the world, and when he's done being president, I don't think we're going to be done with him. I think he's going to go work for the UN and rule the world.
Yeah, well, he'll go work for the UN. How much he'll rule the world, I don't know, but things are going that way, so.
Yep.
Yeah, he sees himself as sort of a figure of salvation in some sense. It's kind of weird and creepy.
So does the media, or they used to. You know, Time magazine put him with a halo on the cover twice.
Newsweek.
Twice, yeah.
Oh.
I think Time put him on as Man of the Year with a halo, and Newsweek put him up recently with a rainbow halo and called him the first gay president.
Yeah, I think Time used a photograph of him with a light directly behind him. So there was sort of this aura around him that looked like a halo. And then, Newsweek explicitly drew a rainbow halo. I guess Andrew Sullivan drew that picture or something.
Who's he?
Signed it. He's a real liberal Newsweek columnist. He's gay, and he writes a lot about a lot of gay issues. Big Obama fan. Always has been.
I heard someone say that Obama has to be the first gay president because Bill Clinton was the first black president.
Right, well. Every president now has to be the first something he's actually not.
Yeah. So, we got about 5 more minutes here. I've said that before.
Okay.
But this time it's real. What do you want to talk about? You like me to ask you questions. No, you got something?
I don't know what I want to talk about. Think of something. We've talked about agorism. We've talked about Ron Paul. We haven't talked about Stacey Litz, but that's fine with me.
Stacey Litz. You know, George Donnelly, I'm kind of I don't like George Donnelly as much as I did. George Donnelly wrote something where he was kind of sticking up for her, which I don't mind that as much. I mean, I kind of feel sorry for her. I still think she's horrible. And, like, you know, in the hood, people who do what she did get tortured and murdered. And she did it to a bunch of aggressionist, so you know she'll just get nasty blog posts and podcasts. But
she'll be ostracized.
Yeah, but George, and she's talking about writing a book about it. I'm like, have you never heard of what's the laws? It's Son of Sam laws, you know.
Yeah.
You can't profit off of a felony. But George Donnelly said something like, you know, I can totally understand if they kidnapped my, you know, if the government took my kid, I'd tell them everything I know about all my friends. And I'm like, okay, note to self, don't talk to George Donnelly.
Yeah, you know, and that was part of a pretty lengthy article he wrote, and I've had a falling out with him myself, so we're not exactly close friends, but I more or less agreed with that article, and I took the thing you're talking about not as I know for a fact that I would just turn immediately, and maybe this is just my generous reading of it. I took it as everybody's got a point where they can be pressured and they'll break.
Maybe. I don't blame him for thinking it. I blame him. I don't like that he said it, because I think it puts him in a position where it would be easier to do it.
Well, he gave away what his pressure point is, first of all.
Right. But, and he's a friend of mine. He doesn't have any dirt on me, but you know, he's an internet friend of mine. And it makes me think like, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm glad I never told him anything. Not that I have anything, but it's like,
right.
Wow. Okay.
But you know, it's been in sort of you know, lore about working, or, you know, revolutionary workings, you know, in secret, covert things, that you just assume that your friend is going to break if he's caught. You know, that's why the you know, the structure of triples, you know, you got little cells of three where nobody knows anything outside that cell of three. So when somebody breaks, you only get those three taken down, that kind of thing.
And the cells of three are supposed to be people that have known each other since they were kids, aren't they?
Yeah. And, you know, the idea is that if they really want to break you, they can, especially in an environment where you can be tortured, literally tortured, which we're getting close to that, but we're not really there yet. You know, everybody's got a breaking point. And I agreed with them in that sense that, yeah, if they push it far enough, there's a breaking point where you'll give it all up.
Well, Stacy is still painting herself as a martyr, which I think is crap. I think the martyr thing to do would have been to kill herself.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying no, totally. I'm not saying she should do it now. It's too late. I'm not saying, God, I wish she'd kill herself. I'm saying if she really wanted to be a martyr, she should have done a blog post, you know, set it to release the next day and said, they're trying to get me to narc on my friends. I won't do it. That's why I did what I did. And then she should have killed herself. And then she'd get to be a martyr and would have saved her friends. You know, I mean, that's what you do. Well, it's the cyanide pill that spies have for when they get caught. You know,
she could have been a martyr just by doing her time, because they're not going to torture her.
Yeah,
you know, they might maybe waterboard her, but probably not even that.
Probably not. But you know, prison can be torture too. I mean, you get women get raped and beaten and abused in prison. You know, and she would have, if she would have totally not cooperated, she could have done 20 to 30 years, more time than if she'd murdered somebody.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's easy to say from the safety of my room, I would have done things differently, but I'll just say this. She ain't no martyr, and she should quit talking like one.
Well, and it's been my point is, until you're there, you don't know how strong you're going to be. You can decide ahead of time what's the right thing to do, but until you're there, you don't really know for sure how strong you're going to be and where your breaking point is. But I've also said that, you know, if I'm in that situation and they break me, I deserve whatever happens to me from my friends and the community and all that. You know, I wouldn't try to say, well, they found my breaking point, so that excuses it, so you should all be my friends again.
It's which she's saying.
Part of being, which she is doing, yeah.
She's also blog posting, basically saying, if people don't quit saying bad things about me, I've got dirt on some of those people.
Yeah, and that's just, she's pretty much gone to the dark side of
that. That's so 180 degrees away from martyrdom that I'm just blown away that she's trying to say she's a martyr.
Yeah, but you know, it's not, to me, it's all about consequences. It's whatever you do is going to have consequences, and no matter how good an excuse you think you had, the consequences are still there. And if that means that your community ostracizes you, well, that's one of the consequences. That's something you have to consider when you're going to break. To try to say, well, I had a good reason, so there shouldn't be consequences, is just, you know, it doesn't follow.
Yep. Well, we're at the end of our time here. You got any closing arguments, sir?
No. Thanks for talking. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, man. It's good talking to you, Kyle.
I've enjoyed the other people you've had on. It's always interesting.
Cool, Kyle Bennett. Take care, man.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiend show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.